Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We hear so much bad news about the environment. However, if you look at the world from the point of view of the soil, actually, you see a lot of ways that we can intervene.
Author Judith Schwartz says nature wants to heal itself. She speaks with us today about the inherent wealth in our environmental economy. Hop in the cockpit with Harvest Public Media as they go crop dusting. Daniel Orr is spending time with his mom, Mary Lou, in today's show. They've started a fire and are ready to bake some brie. And making tamales takes a lot of hands. Chef Erica Yoakum should know. She's known around town as the Tamale Lady. A profile of her in today's show. Our news folks are taking a break this week, so no headlines. Chad Bouchard posted an article late last week, in case you missed it. Researchers have shown that people who cook at home instead of eating out end up consuming less fat and fewer calories without even trying. And speaking of calories, this week the FDA announced new requirements for calorie counts to be posted on menus in chain restaurants. Find these articles and share them on your Twitter and Facebook. We are at eartheats.org. Harvest Public Media is still hard at work for us this week. Crop dusting pilots are the adrenaline junkies of the farm world. They whiz through the air and fly under power lines to apply seeds and pesticides to farmers' fields. It's a high-tech industry now, but it's still a dangerous job. For Harvest Public Media, Jacob McClelland reports.
If you're going to do a story about crop dusting, you might as well start in the sky. I'm flying with Mike Lee, directly above the Missouri-Arkansas state line. Below, it's a never-ending checkerboard of green and brown fields of rice, cotton, corn, and soybeans, with a little Milo and popcorn for good measure.
Mike Lee started Earl's Flying Service in Steele, Missouri in the early 70s, and he's been flying ever since. When he's crop dusting, he flies 155 miles an hour at the crazy low elevation of 12 feet. Farmers hire him to disperse seed, fertilizer, and pesticides by airplane because it's a quick, efficient way to get things done. There's no driving out to remote fields or slogging equipment through the mud. It's all done by air from the cockpit.
This is your basic controls right here. This right here just makes it pull back to go up and down to go forward and right and left, you know. Very simple.
Ag pilots are the ultimate multitaskers. They fly the plane while dodging obstacles like trees and power lines. They don't want to pour pesticides onto a farmhouse or sprinkle the wrong seeds on a neighbor's field.
And so you have to just be able to fly with just the seat of your pants and not even think about flying to do all of that. You know, you got to spend all your concentration looking outside and doing all the controlling the seed or fertilizer or chemical, whatever it may be at the time, you know.
And that's part of what makes this job so dangerous. Pilots' attention is divided, and they work long hours. During the growing season, they fly daybreak to dark every day.
I know some people had accidents. I've had friends that got killed in these things, you know.
Last year, there were 68 crop dusting accidents. That's a big drop, considering that back in 1994, for example, there were more than 150 accidents and 17 deaths. And that was a pretty typical year.
Radio towers, it seems to be the number one problem anymore. You know, these little weather met towers, they stick up overnight and nobody knows about. It's been a major problem in our industry.
Those met towers, or meteorological towers, are thin in metal. They kind of blend in from the air. Farmers lease some of their land to wind energy companies that use them to gather data.
They are very hard to see.
That's Jennifer Rohde. She's an investigator at the National Transportation Safety Board.
They are below the 200-foot requirement that the FAA has that requires them to be lit and marked to increase their visibility.
The NTSB wants regulators to require these towers be marked and lighted, but for now that only happens in certain states. There are other safety concerns, too. An NTSB report released earlier this year found divided attention, fatigue, maintenance, and pilot knowledge as major causes of accidents.
They don't have a large amount of time to react to any sort of an emergency. So important to be aware of the risks of their operations and do what they can to mitigate those risks before they take off, just because it's such a high demand environment.
Rohde attributes the reduced number of accidents and fatalities to better training, more pilots with military backgrounds, and safer airplanes. Mike Lee, the ag pilot in Missouri, agrees. Pointing to one of his planes, he says it's designed to absorb energy in a crash.
As a rule, unless you just go straight in the ground, you're going to survive the crash in these kind of airplanes. It's just going to, kind of like a NASCAR, it's going to disintegrate around you. And most likely the seat you'll be sitting out holding the stick in the seat, you know, when it's all said and done, you know.
And that's reassuring when flying at high speeds only a few feet above the ground. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob McClellan.
Coming up in the second half, the total number of farmers is dropping nationwide, but women are taking up a larger piece of the pie. Another report from Harvest Public Media in about 10 minutes. Judith Schwartz's book, Cows Save the Planet, is really about soil. I was eager to revisit this conversation I had with her last year following a recent interview with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. Both authors agree that when properly managed, grazing cattle can actually improve biodiversity and soil health. Schwartz's book is different from Nyman's in that she came at it from the perspective of new economics.
Which is basically the understanding that the role of the economy is to serve the planet rather than the other way around, which is what I fear is happening, that we humans and all of our natural wealth is there to serve the economy, and that, of course, cannot go on that long.
It all started with her own purchasing habits. She noticed that when she spent her money locally, it made a difference in her town.
Then it's just a short hop to environmental economics. And then when you start looking at environmental economics, you see that the way that we tend to talk about our economy is completely disconnected from the natural economy. And that makes no sense, because without the natural world and natural wealth, we will have no economy. I mean, we can talk about derivatives and we can come up with fancy ways of trading futures and shorts, but there's got to be something at root that has actual value that can feed and clothe and shelter people.
Schwartz focuses on the role cows play in these ideas. Bottom line, she says, the system we have now is not sustainable because the animals aren't healthy. She says the root of the problem is the CAFO model, or confined animal feeding operations.
I don't think it's economically sustainable because the cattle aren't healthy. I would say that we have to change, because what we have right now is a disaster from so many perspectives. We've got the antibiotic resistance problem happening because cattle in such close quarters have to be basically inoculated against all the potential diseases that they might be exposed to. And we have a big methane problem because when cattle aren't kind of crowded together, their waste goes into lagoons, and that just causes lots of methane to be emitted. And I think the main driver of change will be that people won't stand it anymore. People actually do care about how the animals that they eat are raised. They just haven't been informed about it. Actually, one of the farmers that I talked to had a colorful phrase to describe when a rancher changes from the CAFO model to a more holistic model and lets the animals move freely. He says, giving the cattle back their legs.
Here's where the soil comes in. Allowing cattle to roam and graze on grass can restore the land and build soil, of course, if the cattle are well managed. These benefits, she says, are not trivial.
We hear so much bad news about the environment all the time. However, if you look at the world from the point of view of the soil, actually, you see a lot of ways that we can intervene. Soil is kind of a hub for so many of our important biological, biophysical cycles. The nutrient cycle, the energy cycle, the water cycle, and the carbon cycle. So when you do look at these cycles from the standpoint of the soil, by restoring the soil, you can work to restore these cycles. And you could actually see positive changes very quickly. When we look at all of our environmental problems, the one thing that we don't talk about is nature's tendency to heal, that nature wants to heal itself. If we work with nature, things can get a lot better, possibly much more quickly than we ever thought.
Soil is a living thing, after all, she says, and it needs to be maintained in order for us to grow living, healthy food. Schwartz admits that her perspective on food and agriculture has changed throughout her life. When she was growing up, she would buy food wrapped in plastic from the grocery store because that's just the way it was for her.
Once you see how plants grow and how little things that you do can make a difference, I think it does awaken something. Just as an example, I used to think of food that I would buy as a thing. Now I'm aware that it's part of a process. So there is a life to this that I think once we become aware of it, I think it does make us start asking questions like, why does the food in the grocery store look the way it does? Why does it have less taste? Why is it from this country that most of us have never been to? And then the questions that follow from that are, I wonder what might have been lost in the transport, or I wonder what chemicals were put on this plant so that it was able to make it from, say, Guatemala or Peru to my grocery store.
Author Judith Schwartz, asking questions. Her book is called Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. Connect with her at judithdschwartz.com. What questions do you ask about your food? Let's get a conversation going on Twitter about this, at Earth Eats. I combed through the many holiday-ish recipes on the website and found one of my favorites. This is baked brie with all the fixins. Chef Daniel Orr started a fire in which to cook the brie. He's also going to toss in something else delicious. Take a listen.
What I like to do is to take the brie and cut it in half, and that way it exposes that wonderful, rich, creamy interior. And then I can put it right back in these boxes and decorate it. I'm going to put a little bit of salt and pepper on it. And that's just going to kind of wake up those flavors a little bit. And I've got a kind of collection of different dried fruits and nuts. So I'm going to use some dried cherries. And then I've got wonderful Oregon hazelnuts. Okay, and we're just going to push those kind of down into the cheese. Next we'll do maybe a layer of the apricots. So we'll do a little bit of walnuts and some pine nuts around the outside. And then I'm going to finish by glazing this with a little bit of honey. That's going to really kind of bring out the sweetness of the fruit. And it's also going to be kind of our glue that holds everything together a little bit. And then we're going to take this to the fireplace and just let it kind of warm and get all gooey and delicious. Okay, and if you're going to go to the bother of cooking in the fireplace, one thing I love to do is to roast some garlic. And what you do with the garlic is just cut off the little tips of the heads of the garlic, so that kind of opens it up. And we're going to put it in a aluminum foil package. And we're going to season it with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper. And then we're going to wrap this up into a little package. Okay, and then the garlic can get nestled in the coals. And you can do this even if you don't do a big, big fireside dinner like we're doing today. If you build a fire at night, as the coals die down, just kind of nestle this into the coals. And the next morning, you've got some wonderful baked garlic that you can smear on your biscuits or toast or whatever in the morning.
He made a whole feast with that fire. It was incredible. Find the duck recipe at eartheats.org. Coming up,
I want to cook food that tastes like what it's supposed to be. It tastes like what it is.
Chef Erica Yoakum talks about her cooking philosophy and what it takes to produce 1,500 tamales.
Thank you.
production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for being here. The average American farmer is a white man in his late 50s. At least that's who's in charge of the farm, according to the data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But if you dig a little deeper, you'll find women are showing up in new roles, and they're often in the field. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
Sandra Pierce's sugar beet harvest on a small plot of land in rural Boulder County, Colorado, is on pause, and not by choice.
Our beet digger, a piece of it broke, so we'll be fixing the beet digger tomorrow.
Just a small setback for Pierce and her husband, Matt. Both are in their early 30s and have been growing beets, hay, and sunflowers on this property since they graduated high school. And Sandra's taken a leading role.
As soon as I had my son, because I had my son very early, I would put his car seat in the tractor and he would ride with me.
Outfitting the tractor with a car seat was out of necessity. Her husband took a full-time job off the farm to make ends meet.
A lot of the farming has fallen on me, so he would go to work, you know, 9 to 5, and I would do the farm work that needed to get done then, and then he would come home and do a lot of the other stuff.
Leaving Sandra to pick up domestic duties too, taking care of their 3 kids and cleaning the house right after digging beets. And she's emblematic of a whole segment of female farmers, part of a husband and wife team attempting to keep a multi-generational farm afloat. In the U.S., married couples run about a third of farms. But because of the way farm operations are structured, men show up in the data more often. Same is true of the Pierce's farm.
Technically, I don't own the farm. You know, I mean, I just work on it. So I wonder if a lot of things, because, you know, most of the things that we sell are always in his name. Maybe some of the women are there. They're just kind of behind the scenes.
Women have always worked in agriculture, historically. I think a key issue is whether or not it's counted.
Julie Zimmerman is a rural sociologist at the University of Kentucky. She studies how women's roles on the farm have changed over time. Every 5 years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture conducts what's called the Farm Census, which gathers demographic data about farmers. Zimmerman says how that census is conducted matters. The picture of what an average farm looks like changes depending on how the questions are asked.
If you see working on your farm as being part of your role as the spouse or the wife, as helping out, then you might not even recognize it as being working on the farm, even if you're doing it all the time.
The farm census shows the percentage of women farmers climbing. That higher representation in agriculture means women are taking on leadership roles, too. Mary Kraft walks through the milking parlor of Badger Creek Dairy outside Fort Morgan, Colorado. She and 2 of her employees whistle at the black and white cows, coaxing them into the stalls.
So the milk comes out of a cow at 101 degrees.
The dairy is huge. Kraft and her husband split the duties on the farm 50-50. They milk more than 5,000 cows every day. As farms have become more high-tech, the skills needed to be a successful farmer have changed. Now farmers need to know how to work a spreadsheet as well as a combine.
In the past, you had to be this big burly guy with forearms that were the size of a post in order to turn a tractor, right? Because they didn't have power steering.
Kraft oversees her high-tech dairy from an office on site. Her MBA hangs on the wall by her desk. She calls herself a farmer, but she's also a CFO, a manager of 75 employees, and in charge of marketing and public relations.
It used to be you sort of didn't inherit if you were a girl from a farm family. And I think anymore people are going, I want somebody who's going to carry on the farm. So if it's the young lady, awesome.
That's a symptom of changing attitudes and expectations about women and the type of work they do, both on the farm and off. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
More stories about food and agriculture around the Midwest at harvestpublicmedia.org.
What I just ate actually before you came here was a big radicchio salad. So radicchio is one of the winter chicories that's just a beautiful red leaf lettuce. It's in a salad right now with two different vinegars, an aged balsamic vinegar and a sherry vinegar, and brown butter and manchego cheese. I had it with some wild salmon and it was great.
That was lunch for Erica Yoakum. It's not every day you get to find out what chefs eat for lunch. Her salad there was topped with a fillet of wild salmon. I'm down with her in the part of her restaurant she calls Tamalia, the basement of the restaurant Feast. This is where Yoakum runs her tamale-making assembly line. People around the community know her as the Tamale Lady, mostly thanks to the stand she helps run at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market. During the peak summer markets, they produce up to 1,500 tamales per week. Tamales, when you think about it, are like little food presents. The masa is a dough made out of corn. Tucked inside the masa is anything from meat to veggies to cheese, maybe all three combined. Yoakum has her recipe down to a science.
It's not that they're so hard, it's just like they're like kind of assembly line thing. And I think that's how they used to be made, by a bunch of people got together and they'd make them for Christmas or make them as a group. And that's how kind of how we do it now, is going down the line and one person's mixing the masa, someone's pushing it down onto the corn husk, someone's putting the filling in, someone's tying, someone's trimming.
She ate tamales all the time when she lived in California. When she moved back to Indiana, she combined five different recipes to make tamales that resembled what she ate on the West Coast. Her family was so impressed with the outcome that they encouraged her to sell them. Once her business at the farmer's market really got off the ground, she started incorporating local meat and veggies into her tamales. It's high-quality ingredients, like the ones she buys from local farmers, that are the basis of everything she cooks.
I want to cook food that tastes like what it's supposed to be. It tastes like what it is, and it's simple, but using really great ingredients. And if you have really great things to start with, then your food is going to be great.
Great tip for all home cooks out there, thanks to Erica Yoakum, chef and owner of Feast. If you're looking to get your farmer's market fix this weekend, do a search in your area. In Bloomington, the holiday market is happening on Saturday, 10 to 3. The Indy Winter Farmer's Market is Saturday morning as well at the Indianapolis City Market. And Vigo County folks, the indoor market is at the Clabber Girl Museum Saturday morning in Terre Haute. We'll be posting information like this on our Twitter feed this weekend, so keep an eye on that. We're at Earth Eats. Remember that fire that played host to Daniel Orr's baked brie in the first half of the show? It was fed on occasion by some gorgeous bouquets of dried flowers and herbs. These were assembled by Daniel's mom, Mary Lou. It was a pleasure to join them in Columbus, Indiana.
This Does anybody see where I put my red scissors? I just love a fireplace, so they didn't call me Pyro for nothing. But
they called you Pyro?
Pyro, no. What's fun about this is all those things that are still useful, but they're not prime, and you just kind of hate just to throw them in the compost. Like I've got some extra sage, dried sage in bunches that I didn't use, and the birds had eaten all the seeds out of the sunflower heads, but they look kind of nice in this arrangement. Yeah, and then you've got all these different herbs that have a nice fragrance when they burn. And then last but not least, you got all those used ribbons that we're going to use to tie them up with at the end. And I've even got there a pretty old wreath, small wreath, that I'm going to use in the top of one of them. So it's kind of a nice way to not waste anything. So now I'll get going in here. The idea is down at the bottom to have stuff that's really going to burn and doesn't look particularly interesting.
What are these?
Those are blackberry lilies.
So you got little blackberries. They're these beautiful, like, pale purple flowers.
Yeah.
Oh, the spiky one that always sticks to my pants. What's
yeah.
this one?
Yeah, that's teasel. And this is nice. It's Russian sage, and it's still got its blue flowers. Now, see, I'm just folding it up like your local florist would do.
That is the sound of mighty hands tying some twine. So you're really stamping it down.
Yeah, because I'm going to get it inside a wine sack.
Oh, you got to do some more stamping then.
Yeah.
Are you going to be able to fit that in there? I don't know about that. I'm impressed.
There.
Thanks to Mary Lou Orr for the arts and crafts lesson. Pictures of her fire-starting bouquets are on our website. And lots of holiday recipes by her son, Daniel Orr, to help you plan your menus. EarthEats.org. Cheers to our Earth Eats crew, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and the reporters of Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Hope you're enjoying some good food and good company. I'm Annie Corrigan. It's Earth Eats.